So we're going to get started. Just to introduction, my name is Warren Bennett. I'm the pastor at Covenant Presbyterian Church, the church that has done this. This is our third year with this seminar in the spring. The MC of the rest of the seminar will be Drake Barnhill. He has transferred his ministerial credentials into the OPC, the denomination of Covenant Presbyterian Church, and so he's with us as we'll be asking the questions that have been offered or submitted on the internet and asking your questions as well. Chris Stevens is the pastor at the PCA Church in Ruston, and he is going to be introducing the topic of the use of technology. Kevin Olivier is the pastor at Pineville Presbyterian Church, OPC, in, where is that again? Pineville. And so he will be talking or introducing the topic of gender identity. And so look forward to that. I will be introducing the topic of critical theory. And then Quinn Hill, pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Shreveport, he will be introducing the topic of cancel culture this afternoon as well. That is all, and let me begin our time together this morning with prayer. Let's pray together. Lord God, we give thanks to you for your grace and your mercy toward us. We pray that you would bless us as we think about these issues, that we would think about them biblically, that you would be glorified in all that we do and say, that you would be our teacher and our guide, that we would think your thoughts after you. Bless the speakers and bless those who hear, we pray in Jesus' name, amen. Chris, he's going to take your spot.
Okay.
Well, good morning. As I was introduced, I'm Chris. We were able to make it this morning through the storms, and thankfully lightning didn't take our technology out on the way. And I'm excited to have this manner of conversation. I'm excited to have, did that click it? Did that do it? I clicked it. Let's try again. Is it better? Let me see. Did I push the button?
No. Okay. Now we're better? No, okay. I'm excited for this topic as it affects all of us one way or another. All of you used internal combustion engines to get here. I didn't see any horses. That is itself a technology. I have the oldest vehicles likely here that have some old styles of engines, but nonetheless, all are technology. These technological developments, I want us to have a big picture from the general and then end with AI, the newest kid on the block. Technological developments have always been accompanied with fear. I don't need to go back in the time of inventing the wheel or a fire, but we can think that the printing press was a concern for many. However, it did not ruin the livelihood of scribes and monks that had been making books prior to that time. Nor did the power of the elite get underwritten because now uneducated people had books. Centuries later, the e-book did not ruin the print books. Electric shavers did not ruin manly beards. I continue to have that strong. The light bulb did not spoil the use and selling of candles. The microwave has not ruined home-cooked meals. Technology, though, is still a friend and a foe. Just like a knife can be used masterfully in surgery, it can also be used to kill. And so we need to appreciate this balance of technological use. For our purposes this morning, we begin with home computers that became more popular in the 1980s. IBM 5150, none of us youngins know what that one looked like, but it had the little bitty screen, was the first mass-produced home computer system. That created that average Americans now had technology in their home in a different avenue rather than just convenience issues. It did little, though, to change family structures. It did little to change the social relationships within or without of the family. This is pre the internet being used widely.
But in the summer of 2007, Steve Jobs put computers in our pockets. And that is a major and hugely significant shift. Interestingly, Steve Jobs became very rich off of the iPhone and the iPad, but actually banned the use of the iPhone and iPad in his own home and banned his own children from having them. I'd like you to think about that for a moment. When we change technology from some use of convenience to on person was a massive change. Lemke says this, the smartphone is the modern day hypodermic needle delivering instant and digital dopamine 24/7 to us wired generations. It most importantly, one I'd highlight this morning would be information overload. In 1986, some of you weren't there, youngin', you look a little young for 1986, people were confronted with about 40 newspapers worth of information a day. And what that means is as you drive, you see billboards, you listen to radio commercials, and you read the paper or whatever, about 40 newspapers worth of data dumped on you a day. By 2007, that number rose to 174 newspapers worth. In 2004 and 2025 now, we don't have the data yet, but it's exponentially more. That data overload, that information confusion has led folks to have an inability to care, the lack of empathy, the lack of understanding. There's also been a development of an actual inability to cognitively distinguish what is significant and what is not. Also, distractions, something that has been termed now by sociologists as technological distractions, such as checking your email or your phone, causes, now listen to this, this is fascinating to me, it causes a drop of your IQ functionality by 10 points. Now for some of us, that's a lot. For some of you, that might not be a lot. But for some of us, losing 10 points is significant. Now what does that number 10 look like though? Smoking pot is less damaging to your IQ functionality in everyday tasks. It's less damaging than checking your email and receiving phone calls and clicks and pops from your pocket than smoking pot. That's how significant technological distractions are in our everyday life. Many of the technological developments were explicitly designed by engineers for the purpose of consuming your time. Not improving it like the microwave, not fast heating ovens, but actually buying it from you and taking it. For instance, in the late 2000s, when what was now called infinite scrolling, for us that were back in the dot-com ages, remember those dark periods where you had to go to the bottom of your web page, click next page, and then you got to the bottom of that page and you click next page. Well, you now know it rolls more like a game in Vegas where it infinitely scrolls. That invention of the infinite scrolling, listen to this, consumes more than 200,000 lifetimes of wasted scrolling per day. When the internet came out, it already consumed lots of lives. The infinite scrolling took away 200,000 more lifetimes per day wasted on scrolling through digital media. It's a lot. I wonder how many churches could be planted in that amount of time. How many things and world problems could be solved if 200,000 lifetimes of energy were devoted to a task each day? But let's turn to children. I know us adults like to defend and deflect that we're immune to the technological, so we'll think about children, but I'll be honest, much of this applies to adults as well. When children were given smartphones in the early 2000s, 2010 period, when the iPhone became a little bit more affordable, it's now stopped being so, we gave companies the ability to apply a variable ratio reinforcement patterns. It's a complex system that we can talk about later. This scheduled all throughout the day, their week, and their quarters, training them in the same way that we train rats during their most sensitive brain years of how they are wired. Those companies developed addictive apps that sculpted some very deep pathways in our children's brains. And to be clear,
If you put a neurological testing on children, those that have been heavily exposed to smartphones actually have different neural pathways than those that do not. This is a documented and very visible distinction in brain patterns. What about social media? More time on social media, or I would call it antisocial electronics, are more likely to suffer from depression, anxiety, and other disorders. While there's not a direct causation that's established as of yet, the number of correlations between increased time in social media and suicide rates, or at least self-harm rates, is astronomical. Hadid, one sociologist, draws together a number of correlations between increased social media, where people are then less satisfied with oneself. If you ask, how do you feel about yourself? There's a marked difference by two deviations that people are more discouraged in their self-image. They have less close friends, despite the number of likes they might have on Instagram or something else. There's an increased feelings of loneliness. In 2009, a biologist from a very secular direction, an evolutionist, no doubt, said it this way. The real problem of humanity is the following. We have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. It is terribly dangerous. Fast forward 16 years, and the problem, I think, is far worse. So let's think, then, of the last and the newest kid on the block, AI. It's the hardest to understand and most certainly the easiest to fear. I am no doubt going to expect a few Skynet jokes from our brother Warren, as he has told us he will. It's part of what AI opens the door to. By calling technology artificial and intelligent, a number of questions arise from at least those two nouns. No less than Vladimir Putin, the great mind that he is, says this, whoever becomes the leader in this sphere, that is AI, will become the ruler of the world. You have to think that if a man who has been dictating and controlling an entire country like Russia and nukes for that long, if he believes that the person controlling AI will become the ruler of the world, we should ought to think that there's something to that. What is AI technology? Or at least we could better say, the wave of AI technology. Released in November 30th of 2022, ChatGPT is probably the avenue by which you've heard about. It's introduced the public to a human-like technology, a software that supposedly or marketed towards the idea of thinking. There are various kinds of AIs and applications, most of which us in this room will interact with very little. But the one that we will do is what we are referring to as these chatbots. You can go on, you can have it, you can ask questions, it will provide answers. You can have it write essays. You could actually have an essay written in the voice of Henry David Thoreau if you want. And you will likely then pass your English class very easily. It can create code. It can create photos, which is, of course, problematic. It can summarize text. You don't need to read the whole book anymore. It can translate languages, which for this project, I did a bunch of research in German. I do not read German, but I was able to get it with a couple of clicks of a button. It can also compose music and do all kinds of things for us. AI, in the way that we will talk about this morning, is specifically generative pre-trained transformation of data information. It's a generative artificial intelligence using simple algorithms to create new content out of known content. Let me be reductionistic, since the person from my church is not here, who works in AI is not here to correct. In very reductionistic terms, what you do is you put a source of amount of data into the mind of AI. It learns that data, usually in the form of books and texts. A user then asks it questions, and it or gives it prompts to perform, and then the AI neural networks make connections with the known data and guesses at how to fill in the blanks for the unknown. It also, though, is partly schizophrenic and will make up stuff that it doesn't know in order to like all of us, deflect from its insufficiencies to try to fill in. But to be clear, AI does not know anything. It only is processing data. Unlike the introduction of the microwave, the introduction of AI is indeed reshaping and perhaps actually assaulting the very fabric of our world, altering the dynamics of society and forcing very new questions upon us. AI is challenging long-held beliefs about what it means to be a human. It is forcing questions like what human uniqueness is, what is intelligence, what is human consciousness. This technological revolution is forcing us to confront profound philosophical and even ethical dilemmas that we haven't really faced in this direction before. But let me give a pause. It's not all fear when we come to technology and especially AI. There are huge benefits. Let me give a couple from the medical world. In elucidating protein chains, which is what you need to do to research a protein chain, to how to use it for medicine or for the human body, up to 2012, 180,000 protein chains had been well researched. In 1 year, AlphaFold, a certain AI program, was able to do 350,000 protein chains, which is 98.5% of the protein chains in the human body. That's a more than a double, a speed rate than all the humans had done prior to that. That's an excellent rate. However, when AI caught up, in 1 year after that, another program was able to do 200 million protein chains. What used to take a PhD researcher 5 years can now be done in a matter of seconds with AI. MRI scans. If you've ever had to do those, you know you had to go in and you had to sit there for a very long time and you hear that machine roaring around you and then you had to wait weeks longer before it could be interpreted. And typically you wanted a second interpreter to make sure the good results are done. Now, AI-run MRI scans can put you in it and they can have the program read the scan before you were even out. AI is showing a 40% more accurate rate of MRI reading scans. It also can do it in less than 30 seconds, which would take even the best doctors a minimum of 13 minutes. AI is beneficial. But where are we headed? There are, of course, fear, warnings, and a lot of hype that are going on. The college essay is dead. You will not be given AI to go home with and write your essays. You can have it in any voice, as I said. So it's no benefit of having it. Deepfake images and videos are being used currently massively in court cases of lawsuits and criminal investigations. Let me give an example. Currently, in the court systems across America right now, judges are being trained to distinguish between the evidence being given and what potentially could be AI faked. If you have a video of assaulting someone, or marriage infidelity, or some other crime, and the video is faked, that has a huge significance for divorces, child custody, and lawsuits. AI is reshaping our judicial system. What about emotional affairs that you have through chatbots or Second Life? Pastors, are we ready to counsel someone who's having an affair with a chatbot? I'm a little at loss where to begin. But it is happening. What about in the church? A new book that's coming out next month is called AI Shepherds and Electric Sheep. The fact that you have come to a conference says that you are intrigued with human face-to-face interaction, which 2 John and 3 John mentions. So I imagine that we're not entirely excited about having a digital-only pastor. What about AI sermons? How will you feel about that? Who gets paid for that? What about AI counseling? Could you be more open with a dumb computer system than you are with a human? What kind of information are you getting from that? Will you rely upon that? There are no avoiding the intersection of church and AI, or even bigger, the idea of AI and God. Among the many domains being upended by AI, religion stands as one of the most profoundly effective, perhaps a disruptive power of AI to reshape what we think about religious institutions, traditions, theological debates, but the very nature of spiritual expressions of faith-based practices entirely. I think there are very many good avenues, and I am working on some to help our presbytery, and also thinking about how our seminarians can be trained with the benefit of AI and yet also guardrailing ethical dilemmas. Chatbots are now replacing meeting with humans for religious experiences and questions. Recently, this was last year, an AI Jesus, yes, I did say that, an AI Jesus with a visual screen was set up in St. Peter's Cathedral in Lucerne, Switzerland. Over 900 people met on many occasions to have conversations with this AI Jesus that had a fake screen. They did it for discipleship, they did it for counseling sessions, they also did it for confession. It's a Catholic background. Fascinating to me, the overall experience was reported to be positive. The kind of questions and openness that a human would have with a robot, they would not have with another human, a fear of judgment or concern. For us, what I will give just one verse for us to try to tackle our conversation in this topic. Matthew 10:16. Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. Thanks.
Turn your mics on.
Strong click.
So before we give these questions, just for my own review and conscience sake, I will pose the question. Chris, I assume, would be the first to answer the question, and then it would be turned over to the other panelists. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you. And although you mentioned this in your speech, is AI certainly neutral, or is it intrinsically evil?
It's made by humans, so there is no neutrality. Who it's made by, and there's
very, you're off, Chris.
There's many different kinds of AI being made. So their biases are coded into it, and the data they're drawing upon. They have created offline psychopathic killer AI. Thankfully, that's not on the wide web. So they can make an evil AI, but the AI that we're generally interacting with is biased, but it's not necessarily or intrinsically evil. But that doesn't mean neutrality, of course.
It's interesting, your definition of AI, generative pre-trained transformation of data. If it's pre-trained, that means that it's going to carry on the bias of whoever trained it.
If you will compare like ChatGPT 4.0 to the newly released just a couple weeks ago Chinese one, their view of the events of Tiananmen Square are significantly different. If you ask them what the interpretation of Mao is, oddly, the Chinese AI has a very different take than ChatGPT's. I encourage you to go look at it. I've done both. And it, yeah, it's pre-trained for sure.
Did you ever, when you were thinking about this, think about one of the primary uses of AI is with making searches on the internet or any kind of data retrieval easier. Even like the Bible program Logos has a AI thing and or AI assisted search capability. How is that functioning? I mean, that's probably one of the most prolific ways in which we interact with AI.
For sure. In 2017, I published a paper on linguistics and using computer systems to come up with questions that I didn't know to ask. Now, I'm not a technology buff, even though I'm given this part, so I didn't know AI was about to come out. What AI, and I plan on now to write part two of that, AI now can help try to come up with questions I didn't know to ask. And so something like searching the internet
would be very beneficial there. Let me use a very just simple practical example. If you have a water drainage issue at your house, which I think is very practical for all of us this morning, but you don't know what that thingy is called, downspout, goes into a bucket and goes under, you don't remember what that's called. If you beat around the bush, AI can help you fill in to find that exact terms, and of course then give you links to where to purchase it. Now, AI in something like Logo software is intriguing because it's trying to summarize books that you own and don't own. Which books will it choose to give greater weight? I don't know about y'all's Logo software, but some of my books are not by authors that I trust. Now, I have them for various research purposes, but I'm not building my theology of Johannine theology on Boltmann, as much as I like him, as much as I would be looking at someone like a Carson. So where's the AI going to do? How do I heavily weight that? As of now, Logos can't do that. So it brings a lot of questions. I'm assuming you've seen the AI and Logos sermon generator as well. That brings some questions, right?
Yeah, we ask that at Presbytery all the time. You know, we ask potential candidates, what's your view of AI and use of AI in sermon? And we have a very specific answer we're looking for.
I imagine so.
Okay, has AI and social media complicated Christian evangelism? What advice would you give to Christians using AI and social media?
There's certainly a good and a bad. There is a proposal right now from a school down in Australia that is trying to do the idea of gathering all the best Christian apologetic things that have ever occurred. So you're looking from Aquinas on and looking at the best and brightest minds and the best and brightest answers to Christian apologetics. Compile that, train AI to then store that. Then we could ask questions of Christian apologetics from that. That would be a very fascinating project if they can fund that. Could that be considered definitive? Unlikely. But you could have two AI bots debate one another, something like Muslim versus Christians, and really flow out a lot of hours of research very quickly. That's a fascinating thing. So I think there are some goods with apologetics. But we believe that Christianity is a human religion made by God for the benefit of humans, and so it cannot be outsourced entirely. I think we would all agree that the human interaction of discipleship, the preached word, the value of the sacraments in person can't be replaced. I'm separating social media for a moment. So I think in apologetics it has some great value, but still can't be definitive.
I did hear something recently that Facebook used to be a lot more useful with social media when you knew that people in your church would get the post that you made. Now they have algorithms. You don't even know whether they're going to see it or not. And that strange, weird change of the algorithm makes some social media less useful, in my opinion.
You bring up an interesting topic, that the whole way that social media and their algorithms work, whether for good or for ill. If you've ever, whatever your favorite YouTuber is, they'll have one video at some point complaining about the YouTube algorithm has changed again. And all of their videos are now being are decentralized or not pushed out to everybody. For this, you know, to make it very real, our church's Facebook page, where hopefully some of you saw some of our, we'd say advertisement or marketing, but our post, promoting this, the one that Facebook told us on the back end got the most traction was the video, which was a very short video, which was done for, done by one of our members, Ann Mertens, who's sitting here, who deserves a whole bunch of credit for her social media prowess. But all the pictures, who cares about them? It was the video that everyone that, and I think about that is, you know, is Facebook actively trying to promote this? And oftentimes you know, like AI is pre-trained. There's some person in the back, sort of like the Wizard of Oz, behind the curtain, who has an agenda that they're trying to push. And, you know, for good or for ill, which is interesting. I mean, one of the things that people are commenting about Google searches is that they're using AI to pull from websites to give you the information you're looking for without you having to click through to that underlying website.
Right.
Well, what does that mean? That means that underlying website, which might be funded by ads for people who click on it, no longer gets funded because you're not clicking on that website, and it's not tracking that.
On that, there's a lawsuit in California right now for similar things to that, and in the UK as well, where AI is drawing on copyrighted material, but not specifically using the copyrighted material, so the copyrighted owners don't make any money.
Wow.
That's very fascinating.
Yeah.
They are trying to improve it. I mean, there's a lot of negatives, and I've got a lot of stories to think on. But in earlier algorithms of YouTube, it was told to have the explicit design to maximize user attention consumption. Obviously, more time on it, more banners, more money. Simple. Well, what they found is humans' nature, we will spend more time on something like YouTube when we are prone to anger. That's more consuming to us than something beautiful. Now, that would be a whole other conference for us to chat about. But so what they found is, once you have one YouTube video, the bottom then suggests another one. And it puts you on this, what we call the rabbit trail, but it's always inclining you to anger. While they didn't really want people to have the experience of being angry all the time on YouTube, so they actually had to say, well, let's step back and say, we want to consume time, but not create sociopaths. And so they are trying to think about that, of trying to clean it up some, but you're very right. There is certainly an agenda behind the scenes.
Well, even that, you know, is YouTube being, you know, is YouTube really not wanting sociopaths, or are they just not wanting you to have a bad opinion of YouTube?
I think you're right. I think that's a good qualifier. Yep.
Yeah. I guess I have a question about the question. Because challenges to evangelism that are posed by AI, and if you submitted that question, I would love to hear more about it, because I would love to hear a point put on that. What are the perceived I agree with that. I would just love to hear from some of you. Maybe we can do that at lunch. But then to the...
You're not on.
Oh.
I saw that hand in the back.
Am I on now? Check. Nope. Check.
Let me see it.
Now you're on.
Now we're on. We've had these discussions before, but none of us would go to AI to prepare sermons. But for those who are doing that, the question then becomes, who is pastoring the church? Who is actually the model living out the gospel? And the proclamation that you pointed out, I think, is a huge point with the spread of the gospel, with the proclamation of the word.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that we've discussed that at our church. What if we made an AI built around Chrysostom, Calvin, and Spurgeon, and then, man, I'd rather Joel Osteen to get his sermons from that AI than wherever he is getting them. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. I admit publicly I have not written my sermons via AI, and yet I don't want to make this blanket statement just so quickly of saying don't make use of AI. For, you know, what if you have a long paragraph that's a great point, but you really just want one sentence? Could AI help you just kind of speed that up to summarize that sentence, and then you edit it out of that? That's an interesting question, right? Yeah. Or alliteration. Someone like me, I'm dyslexic. Finding alliteration, that's terrible. I have a person in my church, his wife loves alliteration. It's her absolute favorite. I'm being very sarcastic. And so for teasing for her, or love for her, I've made all my sermons for 3 months alliterate. I had AI do the alliteration. Now, those are just the sermon points. You all know those are mean nothing, really. Yeah, so it really, it brings some really, we had an individual on a credentials exam turned in a paper that was AI written, and I was able to prove it and say, well, thankfully he admitted it, so we didn't have that further problem. But we had to explain to him, we want to know what you know, not know what you can find. These are tough new questions in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Would you say that the central problem with AI is kind of Ninth Commandment issues? Because it really depends on where the data underlying that the AI is using. I mean, if you have your paragraph and you use AI to shrink it to one paragraph, well, that's still you. That's still your words that it's processing. Whereas if you say, ChatGPT, write me a sermon on John 1:1-14, mm-hmm. written in the voice of John Calvin, that's not you.
The part of the copyright law, if you go, let's say you go to a web page, I did this as a test. If I go to a page in German, and it's a blog post of, let's say, 1,000 words, and I'm able to beat in German enough of the words, I kind of know the topic. So I cut and paste, and I put it into one AI chatbot like Gemini to translate it in seconds. Now I take that and dump it into a second AI and say, improve the clarity and improve its English. Done. Then I take that and put it in my Word document, and I run Grammarly, which is just a grammar program, to change the vocab words, put in some periods and commas in the right places. What do I have?
Garbage.
Well, what I mean is, if I were to turn that into my own blog post, is it ChatGPT's? Is it Grammarly's? Is it Gemini's? Or do I need to give credit to the German source?
All of them. Here's the list that made this.
This has become a copyright question. What is that? And you can do that in less than 60 seconds if your internet's working fine.
Wow.
And so if you have a church website and you're creating a pastor's blog with that, I think you're very right. Whose blog is it? That's an interesting question to work through, and how do you do that, right? I did not post that blog post, for the record. I don't have a blog, but I like the research. It's a fascinating question.
We are doing our best to get to all these questions that y'all submitted. So if we do not get to your question within our time allotted span, feel free to ask the panelists during our breaks or come and ask your question before we finish this topic session. Another question that someone asked is, and this would be asked with any of these topics, what literature would you recommend to Christians wanting to learn how to use technology in a way that truly glorifies God?
I've encouraged a lot of the people in my church for being mindful of digital minimalism, which is the title of a book by Cal Newport. I'd encourage reading something like that. Just to be confronted with you're using technology more than you realize, and being mindful of the benefits of limiting. If you like a little bit more fun book, something like the book Stolen Focus, you can guess what it's about. And it's a really important thing of our inability to have long-term thinking. It used to be that people are now presently spending over 3.5 hours a day on their phone, and they're touching their phone, just the phone, not even your computer, 2,716 times per day. And if each one of those takes 2 seconds, I want you to think about how much of your day is spent around that phone. Some people put those holsters, so they can pull out their phone real quick. And I think people need to be mindful of what that is and what that looks like, to have a technological detox. You don't have to live in a cabin to do that, but there's other ways. So those are two books I'd encourage people to at least just confront from the beginning of their technological consumption and their addiction to it.
Another book that would be good would be The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. It really shows the destructive nature of a lot of the technology on young people.
Mm-hmm.
He also wrote another book, The Coddling of the Mind. Is that is
American
that,
Mind.
American Mind. Mind. Yep. Yeah.
Him and Lucas did that one.
What was the other author you had cited during your talk? I think he's the one that wrote the something Swan or Black Swan.
Black Swan.
Oh, that I didn't use it for this, but that's Anti-Fragile.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the author?
That's from the business world. I'll have to look that up in the break. Yeah. That's a huge one. It comes from a kind of different direction, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
How are you and your church, this is a more specific question, how are you and your church providing counseling, support, and accountability to those who are struggling with technologically related sins, such as pornography?
Yeah, there's a number of the men in our church that have software on their computers that comes to me, and I get clicks and pops multiple times a day on all their internet activity. And so that's one way to be both proactive, but also it then makes a permanent opening of the conversation. Because any time we have men's groups, well, I'm going to follow up. So it's obviously going to come up as a topic. That one I think is important. Asking spouses what to ask one another, because I obviously can't be there all the time. But encouraging wives to ask husbands and husbands to ask wives helps a marriage avenue of communication that's not in a lot of marriage books, which should be, but it's not.
Another good thing that's helpful is that I actually make sure the deacons and the elders have access to my computer at work. Mm-hmm. I make sure my wife can get into my phone. I make sure that even my kids know how to unlock my phone. Knowing that you have that accessibility to your search history is a good guard.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I do that one too. Yep.
I would say it's a all hands on deck as well. So as I agree with the software angle, but it's also relational. I think pastors should be aware, along with elders, but friends. Like if there's a pointed issue, making connections with other people, having that vulnerable piece out there, I think is necessary.
Have you ever considered getting rid of some of your modern technologies, such as your smartphone? Or if you haven't done that, what are some ways that you guard against the many dangers and temptations that come with the use of modern technology? So that would also include computers or television or things like that.
Personally, yes. I think that human society kind of climaxed after we did microbacterial soap. Everything after that is not good, you know. No, I daily chuckle and say, you know, living in a cabin in the woods with my family and a few people in different valleys would be great. But I don't think that's going to be practical for all of us. But there can be, Cal Newport and Stone Focus also point this out, of the push to do a technological detox really will show your heart how much your physical body reaches for a cell phone. So give it to your neighbor for a day. And then tell them why you're doing it, which might be weird if you don't know your neighbor, but do it. And then you will walk around and you'll be like, wow, what's my hand doing? And you're reaching for your phone. That can confront you, which would then be kind of like fasting and going to prayer, be like, Lord, why is my body physically reaching for a phone I know I don't have? So I think about it often, and I think I encourage a number of our, especially our professors at our church, to think about that because they're inundated with it.
What biblical principles would y'all offer to Christians, especially with the rise of any new technology, for that matter, but specifically with the case of AI?
It's you.
To try to find a biblical zinger verse, when I use it probably for everything, is the being wise as serpent and gentle as doves. The Lord sent his disciples, which is us now, out amongst wolves, which includes the technology challenges we're facing. He wasn't unaware of it. He's not afraid of a little bit of failure, if you're familiar with the passage in Matthew 10. But he's also saying, you need to be wise. You need to be discerning. And so, of course, then we're bringing in Romans 12, too. If you're not actively engaged with thinking and discerning to not be conformed to this world, then you've already given it up. And so now we're back at Owen's thing. Be killing sin. In this case, be killing your addictions, or it will be killing you. And it needs to be a proactive thing. If you are idly just adopting every new technological product that is being sold, you have lost. And I say that with love and charity to say, you've already lost. Now how do we get back in the fight? That's how serious I believe it is.
Well, I'll pile on to that. It's not just technology you buy, it's technology you use. So that would include social media, or ooh, there's this new social media thing, or there's this new whatever kind of technology that isn't physical that we use, that we take, a new website, new social media thing. And that's, one of my favorite quotes from the wisdom of the television show Remington Steele was an episode where they meet with this Japanese Yakuza. And he begins with a profound statement as he gets up from his computer, which was a 1980s computer, one of that had a 5 1/4 floppy disk. That was how old this is. And he gets up and he turns and he says, "We build these machines to serve us and find ourselves serving them." And he says, and that's always stuck with me as not just a nice quotation, but it is a profound thought because it's very true. One of the books I read, they were making this point about email. We were told that email would simplify all of our communication, that instead of spending 5 minutes writing a letter and putting it in an envelope and sending it off and then waiting for a reply, we could do it instantly. 5 seconds, we can send off the email. They said, well, that's going to make our lives, we're going to have a lot more leisure time. How's that worked for us? All right, as Dr. Phil would say, and how's that going for you? Texting, emails. One of the most, I read a story that said that the latest generation are often petrified of their phone ringing. Yeah. Because they're social anxiety about that, because they're so programmed to, this instant communication that happens. We're making ourselves virtual slaves.
Yeah, I don't think about a particular verse on that question. I think about the Imago Dei and the vast, incredible truth of being made in the image of God. Is mine good?
Yeah, there's a few buttons.
Check.
Yeah, you're on.
So it's not a it's not one verse, but it's this reality of God made us in His image, and the incredible value of relationship, and to give ourselves over to something else, to neglect that, I think is neglecting what we're made to be as image bearers.
At this time, we have a microphone stand. You can come and pose your question if you did not have your question answered, or if you have a new question that has come to your mind as listening to our panelists speak.
I just have one comment, and I don't need a microphone. Your comparison of marijuana and iPhone, I don't believe it. And I think anybody that's been around anybody that smoked much dope doesn't believe it either. You need to scrub the statement or get you another source, because that source is wrong.
Thanks.
I don't need a microphone either, but I was thinking, I like to read, but rednecks like to read too, okay? I've got grandkids. If they want to pick up a book the next year or two, I want to read about Calvin, Sovereign of God. How are they even going to know?
what do you mean, how would they know? Like, how do they find the book?
A paperback book hasn't been AI generated. I mean, what's going to be real anymore? What's going to be the gauge that I can trust this? Yeah. And I don't have an answer. I know y'all don't really have an answer, but help anyway.
You see what I'm saying? In the digital world, for sure, you know, deep fakes and things are being problematic.
Yeah. AI generated, but people like me like that too, more.
Yeah, they've done a very clear study. My real field is in linguistics, and I'm pretending to be a technology guy. And one of the ways that we can see the steep and exponential rise in tech and AI usage is a few key like language words and grammatical structures that were rare prior to ChatGTP have exponentially exploded after. So most blogs these days, unless you know the person individually, are AI generated. And they are just talking to one another, to be honest. There is a conformity of language issue that's going on, a conformity of language structures. You're seeing more and more Wikipedia-esque language because guess what's a free source for AI to learn on? Wikipedia. We're not so much having printed books with AI, but you're absolutely right. That's going to happen in the next couple of years. In 2002, one of the biggest awards for literature in Europe, the person after receiving the award admitted that 15% of the book was AI generated. One of the most prestigious awards for art in China, after they won the award, admitted that AI helped the whole process. Photography has done it. A number of fields have already admitted. So is that going to affect literature? Yeah, absolutely. My easy take is get an old book. I mean, I got books from early 1500, so I mean, that's not AI. So that would be a way to do it. And just to be clear, I don't know. I'd probably go toe-to-toe with anyone trying to be redneck. I mean, I got chainsaws older than anyone in this room, and I still run them. You know, I'm a collector. I got about 50 chainsaws, and, you know, I climb trees and cut. So my truck's a 1995 F-350 extended cab, crew cab, 350,000 miles. So, no, I appreciate being redneck, but I also want to be equipped and prepared for the challenges that shepherds need to lead forward. Just as I believe Paul was a Pharisee, and yet he was redeemed and became all things to all people for the benefit of the kingdom of God. And so I'm a redneck from Texas, nonetheless, and yet these are important things I need to become acutely aware of to help. So, yeah.
We only have time for one, maybe two more questions. Now, some have set a precedent. Do not feel cumbered by the precedent that you have to sit in your seat. If you feel like you cannot project as much, you are still free to use the microphone.
Yes.
So we wrestle not against flesh and blood, correct? And the enemy would destabilize us all throughout the day. So I've been mulling over the last couple of years to get rid of this and go with one of those netless phones where I can text and call, maybe put an app or two that would help me on it, but that's it. What's your opinion?
So let me just repeat the question for people. The question is, you know, is there value in downsizing from a smartphone to, for lack of a better word, a dumb phone?
For sure. Think of it this way. You can buy a brand new iPhone for like $800. I get all mine refurbished and cheaper, right? But you can do that for $800. Then you can spend an extra $120 to have this case that goes on it that is then Wi-Fi enabled so that your spouse knows the code to open up the case to get into your phone. You're spending money to have a technology and then spending money to keep you from that technology. Well, I have a lot of problems with that. The dumb phone market is huge. It's actually exploding right now. It's in the tens of millions of dollars a year because a lot of people are going back to flip phones and the old Nokias that were indestructible. I think it's huge. The only reason I haven't done it personally, is I like a camera because I got young kids. If I could, if they could have the, if they could have one of the lower end phones with a camera. Yeah, there are some working and some things, but yeah, I think it's a very strong option, especially if there's been some problems with it. But I think all people should consider going that direction. At least consider it. At least process it. There are some ways too to make your iPhone into a dumb phone that you can restrict your own internal usage. So there's ways and there's some hacks to do.
One more question. Well, if there are no other questions, I suppose that could be a good stopping point for us.